You're listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by the team at Food Matters. Welcome to the Table Talk podcast, where we explore a huge range of crucial issues and exciting developments in the food industry with brilliant guests drawn from all areas of expertise. I'm Stefan Gates. I'm a TV presenter and writer specializing in food and science. Now, this podcast is all about regenerative farming, which aims to reduce CO2 in the atmosphere, reverse climate change, secure our food system, and make it possible to eat meat without a guilty conscience. Now, is this wildly ambitious? Well, to explore the nuts and bolts of regenerative agriculture, we're joined by Ethan Soloviev, Chief Innovation Officer at Howgood, the world's largest product sustainability database. Hi, Ethan. How are you today?
Excellent. Excited to be on.
Excellent. Good. Now, can we just start off by getting a little bit of information about Howgood? Now, we only allow strict elevator pitches, but if you can give us the overview of what Howgood, what Howgood, that's too many questions in one, isn't it? Tell us about Howgood.
Howgood is the world's largest product sustainability database. We assess products according to 127 different sustainability attributes and make that information available in a variety of ways to a variety of actors. So if you're a consumer, a shopper, you can download our smartphone app and barcode scan products to get an assessment of them. If you're a retailer, we partner with you directly to put those ratings in store right next to the price tag, so your consumers can see everything in the store and see which of the products that are good, great, and best for the world. And on the other hand, if you're a food manufacturer, we work in more depth and detail with you to really see all the intricacies of your products and what you can do to improve them, to make them more sustainable, to make them with better animal welfare, to reduce the risk of child and slave labor in your supply chain. We go really into depth and help you figure out how to move your products towards regenerative agriculture, towards biodiversity, and moreover, towards planetary health.
Okay. Now, so we're talking about data here, but how often do you find yourself with muddy boots or in a field or possibly white boots in a food factory?
Well, I am a farmer myself. So I have a 30-acre farm here in the Hudson River Valley, a couple hours north of New York City, where we grow apples and shiitake mushrooms and do a bit of grass-fed lamb, along with a number of other vegetables and herbs and some other trees, chestnuts, hazelnuts, etc. So my boots were on 6 minutes ago. We had twin lambs born on the farm this morning, so spring is officially here.
Excellent. I'm on my way over right now.
And so I think that part of why we have the farm is so that I can keep close to reality. I spend a lot of time on the computer with spreadsheets and data and interviewing, you know, experts from universities and companies all over the world. But it's also important that I'm part of my local farming community, that I am understanding the incredible economic challenges of being a farmer, and keep those understandings alive even as we're doing some, you know, sort of heady global business data research on sustainable food.
And just before we dive into it, who are the main users of your data? Sorry, we call it data here, so I'll bounce that against your data. Are we talking retailers? Are we talking food producers who are looking for ingredients? How does it unfold?
Yes, all of those. I mean, the three primary groups of users we have are retailers who want our assessment because it enhances the transparency in their store. Their consumers love it. Their consumers buy more sustainable products. They actually end up with a better financial situation, better margin because of the way the system works. So retailers love it. That's one of our primary user groups. And then large food manufacturers. So we have partnerships with, for example, Danone and Applegate and others that are producing an array of products where they really want the fine-grained detail sustainability information, and they don't have a single place to get it. There's another large company that we interviewed who I won't name, and we asked them, you know, we asked their product developers, we said, well, where do you get information about if a, you know, an individual ingredient, if an almond for your almond milk, or if a pea for something else you're making, where do you find out if that is a sustainable ingredient? And to the T, they all said, well, we just Google it. which is not, you know, it's great. There's a lot of interesting information on Google, but it's not what you call trusted third-party information about the sustainability, especially across all the different aspects that are out there. And so we set out to solve that and have software tools and information available to make it really, really easy. Even if you don't have a PhD, even if you're not a full sustainability expert, we can put the information right at your fingertips.
Okay. Now let's dive into regenerative agriculture or regenerative farmer, however you like to state it. Can you just define it for us to begin with?
No. Well, and I say that because I've actually written a number of papers about this, that the attempt to quickly write down, simplify, define regenerative agriculture is actually antithetical to how I think about regeneration in the world. And so, yes, of course, I can talk a bit about it and sort of move us towards it, but I want to push back against anybody who says, oh, well, regenerative agriculture is very simple. It's just XYZ. You do these four practices and then you're regenerative. Regeneration isn't like that, because we're actually working to regenerate these living systems, and living systems are not simple. There are no checkboxes. There are no supply chains in nature. This is not a machine. It is the earth. And so with regenerative agriculture, we remember that, and we're working to literally regenerate the living, growing capacity of ecosystems, of farms, of farmers, of the communities in which the farms live. So at a baseline, for me, regenerative agriculture improves the health, vitality, and viability of the ecosystem where the farm is. So that would include the biodiversity, that would include the carbon in the soil, that would include the water holding capacity, that would include the health and well-being of the people who are working on the farm and the people who are eating the food. Ideally, that also includes the economic viability, the profitability of the farm itself. All of these would be increasing, enhancing, evolving. And it's just worth saying that this is pretty radically different than 99.9% of the farming on the planet currently. Farming for a long time has been in a degenerative effect. Soil carbon has been decreasing. Soil's eroding away. Trees are being cut down. Biodiversity is pushed out. Farms are degrading, not regenerating. Yeah. And so figuring out what the path is towards regenerative agriculture is, it's like the most important work of our time, I think.
What are the key elements? So if this is going to end up being on packaging, what are the most important bits that just pop over the wall that make sense to consumers?
You're trying to simplify them.
Schrodinger's cat approach to this.
you just want a few elements. There's, you know, I think different people are approaching it different ways. Let me say that. I don't necessarily agree with all these ways, but I see different approaches that people are taking. I write about this. I do a monthly, not quite monthly. Every once in a while, I put out a newsletter that looks at some of the news and what's changing, what's moving in this space. And more companies, especially surprisingly larger scale companies, this is very different than the organic movement. I should say, from my perspective, regenerative and organic are not synonymous. Organic is not a prerequisite to move towards regenerative outcomes on the farm, although many organic farms will likely have a faster time getting to actual regenerative outcomes. So different ways that people are taking it on, and companies, I should say, is some of them are focusing on soil and saying, look, the foundation of all this is the health of the soil. It is the microbiology. It is the growing capacity. It is the water holding ability. It is the health of the soil upon which all of our food grows. And that is the key for regenerative agriculture. There's also a little side thing in there that you mentioned earlier, which is if you're putting carbon in the soil, that means you're taking carbon out of the atmosphere, which means you're working against the current trend of accumulation of carbon dioxide, and other so-called greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. So that's I would say, most people in the sort of like simplest, I might even say lowest level definition of regenerative agriculture, it's just about the soil. It's about improving the soil.
And is this a cycle that includes livestock as well as agriculture?
Absolutely. Again, it's a living system. So I think that in many cases, part of the reason that livestock has been so closely integrated with agriculture is that animals have an incredible capacity and capability to cycle nutrients and to keep an ecosystem sort of moving and flowing along. The manure from my sheep that run through my orchard, they actually go right under the apple trees and the chestnut trees and everything in our orchard. They are actually manuring the soil. So I don't have to go buy chemical fertilizer or even organic fertilizer from somewhere else because our animals are just moving through the system. Now there's some food safety specificities and concerns you have to watch out for. You're not running the animals through right before you're picking fruit up off the ground. There's a, you know, 90-day wait period, but that sort of cycling. Plus the other great thing is I really don't like mowing very much. Like, I don't like sitting on a tractor, you know, diesel fumes. It's just not my favorite thing to do. And so the sheep are really, really good at it. They mow so much better than I do. And so in many different ways, in many different cases, integrating animals intelligently into a system, especially with the, you know, highest ethical approach to animal welfare that you can have, can really be a boon to regenerative agriculture. It's also not required. You know, there's other ways to go about building soil health without bringing animals into the picture.
Yeah. So I guess at some level, this is a new approach, but on another level, it's an ancient approach where people would do this because they didn't have access to fertilizer and things in the past. So you're saying that 90% of agriculture is not performed on this level.
And I would say 99.9% is not.
Why not?
I would say that partly because this is not just going back to what it used to be. We work at a different scale now. It is a global economy. We are working with incredible efficiencies because of the mechanization of agriculture, because of what fossil fuels have done to improve our productivity, you know, our yield of kilograms per hectare or however you're measuring it. There's a huge amount of change that has happened, and you can't simply go back to a small holding farmer with a cow and some potatoes and a fruit tree. That's just not going to work to keep our global capitalist economic system with the number of people that are currently here working. And so it's not just as quick as, oh, we just go back to something that's ancient. So I actually think a lot of regenerative agriculture will move forward in partnership with technology, with the newest technology we have available, with sensors to be, you know, monitoring the soil carbon and the soil conditions, with really high quality satellite and drone imagery that's understanding the specific details of the fields and where it's going to make the most sense to be putting that little bit of aerated compost tea or microbial inoculant. So I think tech really has to be, doesn't have to be, but it will most likely be involved in a number of the larger agriculture situations in the world moving towards regeneration.
And presumably, I mean, my perception would be that it's easier for a small-scale farmer to be regenerative. But is that actually the case?
I just got to give you a good ecologist answer there, which is it depends. You know, is this a small-scale farmer in the UK? Is it a tiger nut producer in Ghana or Cote d'Ivoire? Is it, you know, a smallholder rice paddy farmer in Southeast Asia? It really depends on the crop, on the location, on the technical support and assistance available, on their access to information, on their interest and, you know, desire to move in this direction. It's not a, you know, there's one very fascinating podcast that I've been following recently is about transition finance for regenerative agriculture. And that's following a 10,000 hectare farm in Germany as it moves in its process towards regenerative agriculture. At the same time, you know, working towards it on my little 30 acres here in upstate New York, and have been on farms in, say, you know, northwestern coastal Ecuador in the last remaining rainforest there that is growing cacao in a multi-story agroforestry situation, working towards regeneration. So it's not necessarily the size that defines what the path will be towards regeneration.
Yeah. Okay. Well, so let's have a little look at that. How is agritech and innovation and database companies like yours supporting regenerative farming methods? What are you actually doing to help that?
So we're working on our side. We're working more on the, I guess you could say, like the demand pull side for regenerative agriculture, as opposed to providing services directly to farmers to help them move in this direction. My opinion about farmers, as a farmer myself, is that farmers are incredibly intelligent, incredibly resourceful, highly creative, just unbelievable innovators. And if there is market demand for regeneration, if there is price from food manufacturers, from suppliers, from governments that are saying, you know, we're willing to pay not just for the food you produce, but the ecosystem services you're creating, or to pay that as part of the food, farmers will say, great, how do you do this regenerative agriculture thing? Fine, I'll figure it out. You know, give me a bit of resources and some direction and I'll get there. So we haven't focused on the sort of data for farmers. There's a number of other platforms that do varying degrees of usefulness on this. One really interesting one that we've been following is a group called Understanding Ag. And they're just brilliant because they really understand this place-specific, farmer-specific approach. There is no single data. There is no single practice that will be the right thing for regenerative agriculture. You have to be responding to the place. The farmer has to understand their own management style, their own animals, their own land, what they want to create. And so Understanding Ag really helps work with farmers on their holistic decision-making towards this place. That is not what HowGood does, and that's not what most of the other sort of data tech side of players do. On our end, what we're most interested in is the larger companies in the world and the smaller ones starting to say, we want regenerative agriculture. We're willing to pay for it, not necessarily that we're going to just pay higher prices for our goods, but we're interested in investing into it. We're going to partner with farmers in our supply system to help them on the way to this journey. And so, yeah, we help companies see the whole spectrum of what's out there and say, where do you want to be? Do you want to move towards regeneration? Do you want to be able to tell the story of improving farm ecosystems, of improving farmer livelihoods, of helping work against some of the global crises we're facing, not just, you know, in the climate, but also in the nutrition side of things? You know, do you want to be part of a movement towards planetary nutrition? If so, here's the data you need to assess your products and figure out, where do I need to source from? What practices do I need to be supporting? What types of certifications do I want to use, and help them make decisions towards that?
And do you think this is supported by consumers wanting that information, or is it companies who are producing products that hit the shelves wanting to have something to shout about?
It's a little of both and somewhere in between. In past agricultural movements, the consumers have really led. I'll go back to the, you know, the organic movement. It was a ground up small farmers, smaller portions of consumers who were really asking for this, yelling for this, setting up, you know, the programs and the processes to make this happen. But it's not quite the same for regeneration. In regeneration, companies are leading. They've understood the larger context. They've understood that it's almost becoming part of their license to operate, to be doing good through their agriculture, as opposed to kind of covering up what's back there in their supply chain in terms of people and pollution and landscapes. And so I think more and more companies are seeing an opportunity here to not just shout about what they're doing in a self-centered way, but actually tell a more complete story. And not even shout, we're finished, we're regenerative, we're done, it's all perfect now, you don't have to worry about it, which was some of the approach earlier in some, you know, certifications that just seemed to say, this is all good, just trust us, it's fine. I think for the millennial generation, for Generation Z, they're a little less, they don't trust that as much, and they want to know the story. They want to know, this isn't all figured out yet. We're working on it.
Dairy farms are failing across the United States right now. We are helping to try to figure out how to support the dairies in our system and other dairies so that they can be more profitable, so they can improve their ecosystems. And we want you to partner with us in helping make that happen. So it's not a kind of cold, calculated, if we shout about this, we'll make more money. There's actual more care throughout the whole ecosystem than I think there's been in the past.
Yeah. Would you perceive that there is a cost attached to regenerative agriculture? And if so, what form does that cost take? Is it a cost of raw materials, cost to the ecosystem? Is a regeneratively farmed potato going to cost more at the point of purchase?
I think it depends. Again, I think in some cases it can lead to that. I guess I should say, first of all, that all of our sense of cost of food is terribly warped.
Yeah.
Right? It's just so far from what it actually takes a woman or a man who's producing food to produce that food. It's just the prices we're receiving are ridiculous. There's a number of graphics you can go and see of, at least in the US, actually the United States Department of Agriculture produces, it's one of the most useful little infographics they produce. It's a dollar bill, and it's chopped up by what percent of that dollar you spend actually gets back to the farmer. And it's just egregious. It's very, very small. So I also look in the United States, we're now spending something like 8 to 12% of our income on food, whereas some places in Europe still have 13, 14, 16%. Some places in the rest of the world have 20, 30% of their income on average spent on food. That sort of level, when we're at the like 20% of income on food, that's going to get us closer to a reasonable livelihood. That's going to get us closer to a place where the people who produce your food aren't committing suicide because of how difficult it is to make ends meet. So I think that's important context here. I think food in general should cost more, but it shouldn't necessarily cost more just for regenerative. It should be all of us thinking about how do I invest. In fact, that's a challenge I sometimes put out to people. I say, if you care about agriculture and you want to help things move, just see what it would take to increase the percentage of your income spent on it and where you would decrease that percentage of income. And that in and of itself could do huge good for farmers, even if you're still buying a conventional, dairy farmer's milk or a conventional vegetable farmer's tomato that doesn't even care about regeneration. That would shift things in a positive way.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's some context. I think where the investment comes is really on the development towards regenerative agriculture. And I think if you are intelligent as a farmer, as a company producing products, in looking at the whole system, you find interesting, surprising little economies. So I'll just give an example back to, cacao farms in Ecuador, where they're growing, cocoa for really high quality chocolate, not just for bars, but for drinks and even sometimes for, cosmetics or beauty products. Part of the key there is developing longer term relationships, setting up buying contracts that actually span more than a month or two or span more than just a single season's production. Mm-hmm. Those sort of relationships can sometimes cut out middle people and lead to very reasonable prices for raw materials through the investment in relationship in projects to move things towards regeneration. So there are opportunities where you don't even necessarily have to increase the cost of your goods in order to be having a regenerative effect. I'll point to some public stuff that's been happening with a large company here in the United States, General Mills. They have announced a number of different trials, regenerative farming trials that they're doing with the oat producers that make oats for Cheerios and some of the other brands in their portfolio, with some of the wheat farmers, with the dairy farmers. So they have these different regenerative agriculture trials. General Mills is not about to double the prices on a box of Cheerios in any way, shape, or form. They have the reasonable, affordable cost of most of Americans in their mind and many people in the world. So they're working very intelligently to figure out where can we do things in the larger system that will allow us to produce the high quality food that we do and improve the soil and ecosystems and water and farmer livelihoods at the same time.
Yeah. Do you see a future where there is potentially on every piece of packaging a little grid that has a list of criteria such as animal welfare, greenhouse gas emissions, biodiversity, social justice, slavery issues, and a mark next to it that says how well this product does against those criteria?
Well, that'd be lovely in a lot of ways. But I think it's a pretty distant path to where that will actually happen. Mm-hmm. There is some stuff afoot in Europe, especially with, you know, product environmental footprint laws. And I think we may move towards there over time. I know California has also toyed with, you know, a carbon footprint number on a package. So I don't think it's definitely not out of the realm of possibility, but I think there are a number of factors that will keep that from happening completely across the food ecosystem relatively in the near term, let's say. I mean, that's part of why How Good exists and why we were created, is in order to provide that without having to get every government, every food manufacturer, everyone to agree with that. We're very agile, we're very small, we're, you know, tech enabled, and we basically produce exactly that. It just doesn't end up on pack, right? You get it right on the price tag when you're working with a retailer that has partnered with us. So I think that information is more and more able to be out there, especially as transparency increases. But I think it'll be a while till you actually see it on pack. That said, there will be claims more and more. You'll start to see claims that speak towards it, you know, reductions of water usage, high quality animal welfare approved, carbon neutral or carbon negative.
The quality of the certification, I guess.
Yes, that's part of it. It also, you know, again, I think just the era of the place where you get information about your food is on the package of the food is pretty much over. Yeah, you're seeing with the rise of online shopping, you're not just looking at a product and making a decision about it. You can look at the product, you can click over to the website of the company that produced it. There's added attributes and information from the retailer that you know who's selling it to you. There's a lot more available than just what's on pack. So I guess in summary to that question, what I would say is all that information will be available more and more and more. You just might not see it in a single unified little, what do you call it? Like the nutrition label. There won't be something like that has it all on there. I don't think anytime soon, but the information will be available to you to make decisions with.
And this all basically plonks us into the big question, well, not a big question, but a sort of side question, really, I suppose, of blockchain. Now, if and when blockchain data relating to every aspect of what's grown and what's produced and the packaging that goes into it actually becomes available to the consumer, will this entirely ruin your business model, or will it allow you to take that data and crunch it and therefore boost your business model?
Yeah, I mean, our business will be great. We've been watching and working with blockchain for 3-4 years now. And basically seeing how it's not yet adequate. We understand what's happening in this space. We're watching it carefully. It definitely will not make us obsolete. At the point where there's enough blockchain information to make us obsolete, great. We'll be totally happy to be moving on to other things at that point. But I think, again, it's a ways. The promise of blockchain is very fascinating, exciting, but we are a long, long ways from the point where it's truly trustless is the term that they use. It's truly, you know, fully automated by a computer, enough sensors everywhere along the way in enough different supply chains that you would really actually sort of trust this trustless system. So I think, yeah, fascinating, useful, interesting. I think that in some cases, the bigger players who are working with blockchain have a lot more interest in maintaining the status quo than disrupting it. There are some players in the blockchain space, Regen Network comes to mind, that are really looking to kind of change the fundamental rules of how things operate. And I think those will be very, very interesting to watch. But I think some of the larger consortiums, yeah, they're basically interested in having things continue the way they are with the new kind of term of transparency and decentralized ledger technology. But are we really going to see the details of what's happening?
Now, Ethan, you are the Chief Innovation Officer of HowGood. What are the innovations that you're working on?
So the innovations that we are building and developing here are really around making regeneration understandable and achievable to every person inside of the companies that are the most important for making decisions now. And so we're innovating new software tools that make it just point and click to improve a product. We're innovating new ways to measure some of the interesting, more important metrics that are coming online. And this is actually worth speaking to a little bit. Part of regenerative agriculture, from my perspective, is that it's not based on practices. So it's not about whether you till or don't till. It's not about whether you're using a chemical fertilizer or an organic fertilizer. The whole thing in regenerative agriculture is about the outcomes. It's about, is carbon increasing in the soil? Are there a greater number and diversity of species on the farm and surrounding the farm? Can the soil hold more water, and is there less erosion and flooding that's resulting from that, whatever agricultural practices you choose? And so finding and using the right metrics, tracking the right outcomes, becomes really important in the move towards regenerative agriculture. So there's a number of them, for example, around biodiversity, that we're innovating new measures, new ways that you can quickly and objectively assess the level of biodiversity in a particular product that's out there. We're looking at new measures like the Planetary Health Diet, which was proposed last year in a landmark medical journal, The Lancet, that's basically saying there is a way that you can eat that is simultaneously the most healthy for you and the most healthy for the planet. And so that's a great idea. It's quite brilliant, actually. But we don't have a single unified metric that someone could look at and quickly assess, is this product, is this vegetable, is this meat, will this help me move towards the planetary health diet? Yes or no? And so we're innovating new ways to quickly measure that in a sort of mass way. So it could be applied to the million products or more in our database, or the, several million products that are out there in the world.
Okay. Now, from your own personal point of view, this is a question that I always love asking. Is there something that hasn't worked in the development of HowGood and within the concepts of regenerative agriculture that you thought would work and that you're surprised about?
There was some times early on where HowGood thought that we were a little more what you would call activist at the beginning. And we thought, okay, we're going to make a scale from 1 to 10. And 1 through 7 is terrible. 1 through 7 is just, bad quality food. It goes from the absolute most destructive for the planet and you all the way up to, you probably shouldn't be eating this. But, 1 to 7 was just not good. They were all red. Only 8, 9, 10 were really like, yeah, this is pretty good. This is great food. This is the best possible food for you. And so in some of our early trials with retailers, we tried out putting the full ratings 1 to 10 on every product in the store. And that did not work very well for a couple of reasons. One, retailers really didn't like 70% of the food on their shelves with red stickers next to it that says, this is shite, don't eat it. So that part didn't work. But then what was interesting, which we didn't necessarily expect at first, was that it also didn't work with shoppers. Shoppers would look at it and say, well, who the hell are you? I really like this product. How dare you tell me that this is bad for me? I'm going to get it anyway.
Yeah. And it's like telling a child that chocolate is bad.
Exactly. Yeah, it just immediately lost trust in the system. And so overall it didn't work. So we shifted to basically an all positives rating system, but we still only put those 8, 9, and 10s on. We still only mark the good, the great, and the best. We just we don't put a label on anything else that kind of doesn't meet the standards.
That's I love the evolution of it working like that. Now, just to finish off, could you tell us a little bit about the future for regenerative agriculture? What do you think is achievable in the short term, and what do you think is the reality in the long term?
Short term, things are moving very fast. I put out a map earlier this year of the regenerative agriculture industry that basically showed the exponential rise in the number of companies, organizations, farms that are using the term regenerative agriculture to describe what they're doing. So things are moving very quickly. More and more large companies are picking it up. You see coalitions like the One Planet Business for Biodiversity Coalition, which is 19 companies, not just food, but across food, fashion, beauty, who are all basically saying, amongst other things, we want to promote and push forward regenerative agriculture. That consortium, at least upon its founding, had 19 members that had $500 billion in annual revenues. So that's pretty significant. And their three pillars were to promote biodiversity in their products and portfolios, to support regenerative agriculture, and to protect and uphold the integrity of high-value ecosystems, forests, marshlands, et cetera, around the world. So those are pretty significant commitments from some pretty big companies, from Mars to Nestle to Google, even, was a part of that group. And you know, fashion like Kering was part of that, and L'Oreal. So it's pretty significant to see that major global companies are turning in this direction. And in the short term, I certainly expect to see more of that. I think companies that don't do it will relatively quickly be left behind, because there's something about regeneration that is so much sexier than sustainability. It's just, there's something, it's so intuitive for people to say, I don't want to do bad, I want to do good. That whole sustainable idea of like, we sustain, we get to net zero and we maintain it and keep it there. It's just not as will generating, as kind of awe-inspiring, as exciting to be a part of as saying, wait, let's actually do good with everything that we're doing. Now, that's what's going to take a little bit longer, is for the global agricultural system, the global supply system, to figure out how to do that. There's still a lot of products out there with palm oil in them that have come from the destruction of rainforests. And that's going to take a while before that changes. There's still, you know, something like 40 million people in some form of modern slavery in the world right now. And some work on that, so say, for example, in chocolate and cocoa in Ghana and Cote d'Ivoire, has been ongoing for 20 years with millions of dollars and has shown very little progress. So we have some work to do until the actual outcomes are regenerative. So I think that's the short-term, long-term difference. Short-term, we'll see a number of more players head in this direction. Long-term, we'll actually see the achievement of aspirations that will come from intelligent thinking, intelligent working, and moreover, taking some of the ideas of regenerative agriculture and figuring out how to apply them to business, to think about regenerative business in the boardroom, in the decision-making of everybody inside some of these companies and investors. That's sort of regenerative business, regenerative investing. That's coming, but a little more sort of mid to long term until it really comes into effect.
Beautifully put. Okay, well, the sooner the change comes, the better, I think. Thank you so much for joining us, Ethan. And we look forward to catching up with you in the future to see how it's all evolving.
Thanks so much.
Okay, you've been listening to the Tabletop Podcast with Ethan Soloviev, Chief Innovation Officer at HowGood, and the first farmer that I've spoken to that actually understands blockchain, and me, Stefan Gates. If you enjoyed this episode, you might like one of our other podcasts in which we explore pretty much every aspect of the food industry, from farm sustainability and salmon farms to lettuce picking robots. Take a look at all of them at foodmatters.co.uk. Goodbye. You've been listening to the Tabletalk Podcast, brought to you by Food Matters. Subscribe to get every episode freshly delivered on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And to find out more, please visit foodmatters.co.uk.